They felt called to missions since they were married in 2001, but it was a long 10-year journey before God showed them where to go. Their journey has included 6 children along the way, their ages ranging from 13 to 3, with another baby due in January. They left their home in the U.S. in 2012. They moved to Canada to learn French, and a year later they moved to Chad, which they now call their temporary home. They'll be in the Twin Cities until March when they will, Lord willing, return to Chad. So welcome, Lindsay.
Go. Can y'all hear me, see me? Hopefully we'll get that started. I'm really excited to be here today. I feel like I've seen so many of your faces. There are some really familiar faces here, but I haven't ever been to Moms North. She said, we didn't come to North until 2010, and we had kind of more been downtown. So I did Moms Downtown for, I don't know, probably 6 years, and I love Moms, and it's just really sweet to be here today, and even just to be able to get to know some of you. I feel like going away for even just 3 years and coming back, there's so many new faces at the North Campus, and familiar faces that I don't see anymore, and yeah, I just feel like I really want to reconnect, so thank you for having me. Let's see if I can get this started. I don't know, as I was praying about what to share, I just thought, well, Moms is a time to connect with other moms, so maybe I can connect you guys to some African moms. I'm kind of a link. I don't know if this is going to be exciting to you, but I hope that you find that women can connect all over the world. So I'm going to introduce my team. I thought, well, I could introduce my family, but we're moms. I left my family at home. So, in a sense, this is my mom's group, even though one of them's single. So, these women are all part of our team. We're with Pioneers, and God just miraculously brought our team together. I mean, we didn't plan it, but we did pray that God would bring us around other people to be supporting each other. The woman in the middle with the baby is Sonia, who we've prayed for this morning. She's also a Bethlehem Global Partner. Some of you probably recognize her. The woman on the right is a friend who came from the Wisconsin area, and she is a unique mom because she has one child with severe disabilities with Treacher Collins, so they manage medical things, and 2 kids. She's got 3. Her other 2 are severely dyslexic, so her first term overseas, she's just been dealing with, like, now she's homeschooling, and it didn't quite go like she planned. So, you know, we're supportive of that. And the one I'm standing by, I've got the short hair on the left. The second woman from the left is Sarah. She's from Indiana. I guess you could say she's our youngest mom, but she's on her 4th already. And then the woman in the gray shirt with the headband is not a mom, and she's not married. And so it's been a unique challenge to try to envelop her in as a single woman who's my age. I mean, it's really funny because sometimes she connects with my daughter, and sometimes she connects with me. And I just find that such a joy to see. And she has a unique role on our team. So some of the pictures you're going to see are these women's pictures, and, you know, we live loosely together. Our hope is to all be in the same city coming up in the next term, but in the last term, we were kind of spread out because we were learning language and trying to set up ministry in a village and different things. So over these last few years, it's been really a loose connection. Some of them living, you know, right next door, and some of them living 6 hours away. But in this next term, we really hope to be, like, in each other's lives daily, praying for one another, really having a lot of this fellowship that you guys get to have. So I'm really looking forward to that this coming term. This is kind of a picture of my life in the last few years. In Africa, you sit on a mat. They don't have chairs and comfortable places to sit, but you find it's not bad to just sit on a little plastic mat. Women drink tea and eat peanuts. And so my life has been a lot of language learning. As you can see, my language notebook is there. So as we make food or as we do whatever we're doing, I'm just trying to write down or soak in or record or whatever I can do to learn a language in hopes that someday I could communicate with these women the truths that they've never heard. And so today I just want to talk a little bit about things they've never heard and things that we've heard that we don't even realize we've heard, whether it's through the Bible or whether it's just through our culture and our society. And it's just amazing to see, wow, this woman has never been told you've been loved by God. So anyways, yeah. Well, sorry, I'm going to have to. I put my notes on the side, but I didn't realize I might not be able to look at them while I have this up on the screen. Should have printed them out. Okay, we'll go back and forth. Sorry if this is going to be kind of crazy. This is a picture of girls that our kids play with. I can't exactly tell you all the names, but you'd be amazed. African names are, there's like five of them. It's like Fatuma, Amna, Ashta, Miriam, and I mean, seriously, you just meet another one, another Ashta, another Miriam, another. So I didn't even try to write down these girls' names, but in one way that really personifies what society thinks about them. You're just another girl. And in Islam, girls are just devalued. They're told from the very beginning that you're not as good as a man. God does not value you. And on top of that, you are the reason that sin came into the world. And so just imagine, you know, hearing that your entire life, that you are not valued. And it's that way in the educational system. It's that way in the mosque. It's that way in so many ways. Opportunities go to boys. If you have only girls, it's kind of a shame to your family. So I don't know. It's just even in American society, I think we're so blessed to feel valued as women and to be treated as equals, and they just don't have that sense of worth or love from God, which, what they hear is just they believe. And so I just find it amazing that in our culture, when women are devalued, we stand up and make a lot of noise and say something about it, and they don't. It's just the way it is. It's not something to kick against or to be upset about. It's just where you play a role in society. And so the one thing I can say is that's kind of interesting about that is you never hear women complain about where they are in life. Like, they don't want to be men. They don't have this desire. I mean, some of them might aspire to great things and don't have the opportunity, but girls are happy and women are happy. And I find that interesting that so often women here can be so discontent and you want something more. So I feel like I'm learning from them as well. But it is really sad still. It makes me sad to think of these women that are going to walk in their mother's footsteps. And Lord willing, maybe they won't. Maybe they would have a different life. Sorry, I'm going to jump back to my notes real quick. I was thinking, kind of the thought that I had was that we believe the things that we are told, and that takes faith. And that's what our religion is about, faith. I mean, they do have a faith and a religion, but they don't have a truth to stand on. So what they've been told are lies and alterations of stories from the Bible. So I just feel like I want to be able to tell them things that they can believe in faith. So, for example, I want to be able to tell these girls someday, Galatians 3:28, there's neither Jew or Greek, slave or free, there isn't male or female. For you can be, we are, but they can be one in Christ Jesus. If you are Christ, then you're Abraham's offspring and heirs according to the promise. So I'm struggling with language because someday I want to be able to tell these girls, you have value in God, and it's not because you're a man. It's because God made you and he loves you. And Islam women are also taught, like I said, that they're a curse in the sense of Eve was the one that brought all of creation into sin, and we're part of her. And so men often just look at women as shameful, or, I mean, that they can bring shame on their family, and things that they do can be shameful. And you just hear this word often, shame, shame, to the point that, like, to go to the market and drink water in public is a shame. And you go, where did you get this? Who told you that? You know, oh, they just told us it's in the Quran or it's this. Or that. I mean, there's no like hard facts about what God says or whatever. It's just that's what we're told. So this idea of shame just hovers over them. And so they cover and they wear these robes or sometimes they'll wear ones that you'll see like the Somali women wearing, just the long black abayas or sometimes burqas they're called. But in Africa, at least there's some color. These women have held on to their African roots and they wear like just the long cloth covering, which is kind of fun. But man, what a pain in the rear to, it's 115 degrees outside. Your clothes are already drenched. Now you've got to wrap this fabric around you that like restricts your movement or I don't know. I mean, from the very beginning, they're taught you just have to do it. You have to cover. You're going to make men stumble. You're going to, it's just amazing the things that they say and the women just believe it. And so when we move there, they say, oh, you need to cover. And in some ways it's true. I mean, I find oftentimes the culture there being so conservative in dress is kind of nice. We'll go places in the middle of summer and I'll just be like, there's so much skin. I don't know what to do. You know, people half dressed. But at the same time, like they're doing it because they feel shame. And that's, I think, just a lie of the devil. And so we struggle in language to be able to tell them truths like James 1:4. A person is tempted when he's lured and enticed by his own desire. When desire has conceived, it gives birth to sin. And sin, when it is fully grown, brings forth death. So they're taught, if men stumble, it's your fault. Well, I would want to cover too. I mean, wouldn't you feel awful to be the responsible party in shame on your family or on others? Here's a picture just of a little girl covering her head in the market just because she's been told that's the way she has to live. I do. And not because I feel that shame, but because I want to be able to engage with them. And if you don't, they have ideas of women that don't cover. And it's from Hollywood or ideas from what they've been taught at the mosque or whatever. So they won't engage with you. You're just labeled like a prostitute, basically. And so it's like, well, I don't want to be that. And after you've been there a little while, you feel like your white skin is so just like a flashing light bulb that you're like, yeah, I'll cover as much of myself as I can, just so people don't flock to you or swarm to you or whatever. This is a picture of my friend Stephanie, who went to a wedding. And well, we went to this wedding, and this is what the woman does on her wedding week. She lies in bed covered. And I think it's because it's kind of a shameful time, you know, like sexual issues are never talked about. They're just taboo. And I mean, I can't imagine how she feels on her wedding day. Her mother has not prepared her. In fact, they probably told her the week before, "You're getting married." I think this girl was 17, and probably to a man that's 40. I don't know, maybe. She may be the second wife. She might be the first wife if they're wealthy enough. But the reality is that she feels shameful. Nobody's ever told her that God made sex to be a glory to Him. It's kind of a shameful thing there. And so all she wants to do anyways is kind of cover and hide in a hole. Like, it's just such a strange way that they've distorted some really wonderful things God has made about men and women, and they've just slapped shame on it, and now she doesn't know how to respond. So it's tradition that they cover up for their wedding day. They just kind of lay there in this bed, and they don't talk, and people bring them gifts, and they kind of have a party all around them, and then they'll oftentimes build their house onto the side of their parents' house, or the woman will live with the parents and the husband will live just nearby. And so, like, for the first week, she'll just spend the night at his house, and then during the day, she sneaks up back to her parents' house and just acts like nothing's happened. They don't talk about it. They don't, you know, have dialogue. It's just the way life goes. And when you ask them, "Don't you want something different for your daughter?" It's just, "Well, that's the way it was for me," and life goes on. And nobody's told them it doesn't have to be that way. And even like after, maybe she's been divorced later or her husband dies or whatever, I mean, it's very unlikely that she's going to have a hope of a wonderful new relationship or even love. They laugh when I say I love my husband, because love is not part of marriage. It's more of a contract. And so it's just so strange for them to think about having somebody that cares about them. But someday I hope to be able to tell them about the woman of Samaria who came to draw water, the well. And Jesus said to her, "Give me a drink." And she's wondering, "Why are you asking me for a drink?" She knew she had shame. I mean, the people of Jerusalem labeled the Samaritans as shameful people. And she even knew in her past that she was carrying shame with her, and she's wondering, "Why are you associating with me?" It's kind of that same idea of like knowing that you're carrying the burden of shame. Why are you engaging with me? And yet Jesus just pursued her right to her heart, and he cared about her. And he said, "If you knew the gift of God and who it was that was saying to you, 'Give me a drink,' you would ask him, and he would give you living water." And so I hope someday to be able to tell women, shame does not matter to God. He's come to remove your shame. He even bore it for you on the cross. So hopefully someday things will change. And I just put that, I thought it was a fun picture of women looking for water at a well. I mean, this is how they get their water every day. Women, often actually the girls, because it's a menial task. So the mom stays home and sends the woman to, or their daughter to the well, and maybe as young as 5 or 6, just take the donkey, go fill up your water, come back. And I mean, the reality is, their women or their daughters are so vulnerable. I mean, to mistreatment, abuse, even in refugee camps, it's even worse. They have nobody to protect them, and so even if they are abused, they have to carry that shame with them. There's no way to get rid of it in Islam. This is my house helper's neighbor. We can call her Zahra. Women in Chad are bound in poverty along with shame. There just are. It's a poor country. This little baby was born probably prematurely. He was like I think he was just a few months old when I met him here. But he had a problem. I guess his intestines were not connected to his rectum, so they had a colostomy bag, or I can't say that word. And because there's not a whole lot of medical treatment, it was really just a hole that they had cut in his side. And then they just sent her home to care for this little baby. I mean, the reality is it's probably going to get infected. He's probably not going to live. And that's just the way it is. When you meet women and get to know them, oftentimes you say, how many children do you have? And it's usually, I have 7, 3 living, 4 dead. That's just the way they introduce their children. And it may be that they had, that's usually children that have been born, not just miscarriages, which is often common as well. But they just expect death. And there's no way out of it. Like, what is she going to do? She's been to the hospital. They can help her, you know, this much. And even there's like, I think there's 4 doctors in the country per 100,000 people. So even most people aren't even in the reach of medical care. Because we lived in a city, you could go to the hospital, but you kind of go as a last stitch effort. Like, I'm headed to death, so why not go to the hospital and maybe something good will come out of it. But a lot of people go to the hospital to die. Surprisingly, this little guy lived for, I think, a year or almost a year when they kind of had told her he's too little to do major surgery, but maybe at a year we can try to do something. Well, after a year, she went, and they pretty much made excuse after excuse as to why they couldn't do the surgery. He's not well. We don't have enough blood donors. Maybe if you could find some blood, we could give him some blood before the surgery. But the reality was, I think they were trying to tell her, we can't help your baby. But they couldn't tell her outright. But he didn't live. He ended up dying. And it's sad because I feel like I want to tell her, Jesus can help you. I don't have medical capability to help you. I mean, even though my husband's a physician, he can't do the surgery here. I don't have enough money to pay for anything to help your child. I cannot help you. But I know the good physician, the healer, the one who can. So, we struggle with language so that someday we can tell her that Jesus heals and he will help you. He can do miraculous things if you call out to him. So, Lord willing, someday. This was a neighbor of ours, another situation where she'd come to live with her brother and sister-in-law, who were our neighbors. And I think she was just sick and had been living in a place where they kind of just said, there's nothing more we can do. And they couldn't do a whole lot. So she came to live next door, and we kind of got to know her. And then we had actually moved houses in the middle of our stay there in Chad. So we hear the news that she passed away. And you can't really tell how sick a person is when they're covered in these robes. But oftentimes when you see their arms or their legs, it's just like, wow, you really are sick or something is wrong because you're so skinny. It's just almost like shocking. But I really feel like, well, number one, things don't change overnight. I don't expect that even if a few people become saved, that the country's going to change and become a flourishing green valley and people are going to be not malnourished anymore. But I do feel like God can give individuals hope in the midst of hopelessness. They really feel hopeless about their life in a lot of ways. Anyways, also, just the note on poverty, like, they just live day to day. This woman came, and basically she would boil sweet potatoes or yams and then sit out in our yard, or not in our yard, but in the street in front of our yard, and just sell them to people that walk by. And that was how she made a living. And so she made just enough money that day to buy food for the next day, and then she would go back. And so when things like medical expenses or travel or anything comes up, that's it. They just can't go. They just can't take the expense. They just don't have it. And oftentimes their family doesn't have it or their neighbors don't have it. I just think of the wealth of resources that we have here. I mean, I've never been in a place where I've had to reach outside of our family for financial help, but I know it's there. I know there are people that would gladly, help with needs. And it's a beautiful thing to see that in the church and to know that that is God's design for his church. Okay, sorry, back to my notes. I want to be able to tell these women, cast your burden on the Lord, and he will sustain you. He will never permit the righteous to be moved. And I know that doesn't mean God heals you every time. God provides money for every situation. But I know at the same time that he can, and if he wants to, he will. And if he doesn't, it's because he has good for us. This next picture is a language helper of our teammates. We call her Om Bashir. A lot of times women take the name of their firstborn son. So I would be Mother of Eliana. So her son's name is Bashir. She's Om Bashir. It's a sweet way to name, just to adopt the name. But in a sense, it's kind of like, oh, you're not as important. We're just going to change your name to Mother of somebody. But to us, she's Om Bashir. In Chad, women bear the burden of taking care of their families. So these women work so hard. I cannot believe how hard these women work. They work from sunup to sundown. They wash the clothes by hand. They make their meals from scratch. They cook over wood fires. If they want to go to the market, they may walk 15 minutes or maybe more. They carry things on their head like I can't imagine because they're just walking on a dirt road. You can't haul a little thing behind you or drive a car. Oftentimes these women are strong women. Like sometimes I'm just amazed at their strength and their stamina. But at the same time, like their life expectancy is probably around 50, because their lives are just really hard. A lot of physical work. During the planting season, who does the farming? It's the woman. You won't see many men in the fields. So if a woman wants to, because men will often have multiple wives, they kind of have work that they do to take care of their own kids and their own family. So Om Bashir had this small field. And during the rainy season, they get up before the sun comes up, go out to their field, which may be 2 or 3 hours walk away. And oftentimes they'll actually just sleep out there because I wouldn't want to walk 2 or 3 hours back just to get up and walk 2 or 3 hours the next day. So they'll take all their stuff, and sometimes they can find or pay someone to give them a ride out there. But if they're poor, they just go. They kind of set up camp. You can see over by the tree where they've set up like a little kitchen, bring their cooking ware, and then they just find water down by, a hole or somewhere, and they just make do. And they work hard in the field. I mean, it's hot. They just work in the sun. They plant millet, which is kind of their survival crop. And then they also plant peanuts, which is also a really healthy source of protein if they're not eating a lot of meat and things. So the sad thing is oftentimes it'll like rain for a short time and it looks really hopeful and then it'll just stop. And there's no way to irrigate. There's no way to like haul water from the creek. There's no creek nearby. There's nothing. So it's often really, really discouraging when it just doesn't produce. And it's not like they have savings where they just go, oh, well, now we don't have any food for the year. We'll just buy it as the year goes on, which in a way they end up having to do. But they just eat less. That's kind of the way it goes. And it wasn't necessarily the case for Omashir, but for other women, I've heard that they may choose one of their children that doesn't eat. Or, I mean, it's just a matter of, we don't have enough food for all our kids, so we pick one. So sad. I couldn't imagine. But at the same time, I want to be able to tell them that God cares about them. And he says, come to me, you who labor and are heavy laden, and I will give you rest. They just bear these heavy yokes of being the provider for their family. And Jesus says, take my yoke upon you. Learn from me. I'm gentle, I'm lowly in heart, and you will find rest for your souls. For my yoke is easy and my burden is light. And they've never heard that. They've never heard that they don't have to work like a slave-driven person just to make the next meal. It's a good question. Oftentimes men find like, oh, thank you. They try to work either in town, and that may be keeping a store, which looks like sitting in front of it doing nothing all day. We still have yet to find out what do the men do. Often they're traveling. I mean, you ask a woman, where's your husband? Oh, he went up to Libya to find work. He hasn't been around for 4 years. They haven't seen him. I mean, they're just absent. I mean, it is really sad to see, like, here we talk about different populations being, like, absent-fathered, and it's really true there. And they don't see a good pattern of what does a dad do? How does a dad provide? What is his responsibility? They see a mom providing, and again, it's like they don't know any different. No one's ever told them it doesn't have to be that way. Technically, under Islam, they should be able to go to their husband and say, this is a shame. You are not taking care of your wife. But traditionally, that's not the case. Occasionally, you will find a woman that is provided for, but it just depends what group she's in, where she sits in society, how many wives her husband does have. Did he get injured? Maybe he can't do any more work because he's been hurt . It's one to the next, but in a lot of ways, men are just not part of families, sadly. This is just a picture of her daughter plowing the fields with the donkey, which they're really blessed in a way to have a donkey because a lot of women do it by hand. So this is her daughter, I think her oldest daughter, and she's probably 25, maybe a little bit older than that, but her name is Kubra, and she has had two kids. You can see the one little boy peeking in beside her, and then this little newborn that she had actually just before we left this last spring. But again, there's so many like just natural disasters or ways that it feels like the world is working against them that they have no control over. So for example, her house is made of mud, brick, which is just what they have. They don't have anything better than that unless you want to pay a lot of money for cement. But what typically happens is the rains come and all these mud walls just begin to deteriorate and flooding. This is when people usually get malaria because there's just standing water everywhere. But we've seen this happen twice. Maybe a heavy rain comes. So one night while they were sleeping, and she's sleeping in her mom's house because her husband's off who knows where. So they live together in a yard, but she's got her own room. And it rained so hard that the whole side of the house actually just caved in on them. And her little baby, who was 4 months old, just got crushed because the weight of the wall had fallen on him. And thankfully, their older son, who was just, I think he was 2.5, he suffered a fracture to his skull, but he's fine now. But that was just it. There wasn't anything to do. The house had just fallen down on him. And it's really common. I mean, we had friends that were living kind of in a Chadian home, and they were away on home assignment, and it rained so hard that their whole roof collapsed in on them. We just are thankful that they weren't in there. But